So it's a bit more kind of miscellaneous, and it's actually got quite a lot of black magic and things like that in it.
Turning away.
Evil spirits and things.
So it can be like magical.
Yeah, it'd be like our go away all the animals and things like that, yeah. So it's a bit more like your kind of local common or garden variety magic spells and things like that, which was not quite orthodox enough to be put in with the three Vedas that got kept as the final, kept a bit out.
So the Gorgon Head is a
what is it?
The Gorgon Head would be a symbol.
Anything
to ward off evil.
Okay, like the nagas you have in the temple.
Yep.
Temple? Or the temple?
They're both skulls, but also human arms and things.
So this is the things. Okay, and then notice how these are some associated with different kinds of officials at the ritual. Rig Veda associated by the Hotr and the Advaryu is the Yajur Veda Nudgatri. That's pronounced. In addition, that each of those Vedas has its own kind of ongoing tradition. So each Veda is in some ways associated with the later literature. So say we'll look a bit later at the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and that's connected with the Saman Veda and so on. So each kind of there's these strands which were probably like local variations or had some kinds of either different ritual purposes or localized in different areas and these kinds of things. Okay. So here's the different terms here. It says there's various divisions. Sanyita, Brahmana, Aranyaka, Upanishad. We'll just have a look at each one of these. Vedic chant. This is Sanyita. So I think the Sanyita just refers to the collection of the Vedas as such. The Brahmanas are part of the Hindu Shruti literature. Their commentaries on the four Vedas detailing the proper performance of rituals. Each Vedic shakha, each school had its own brahmana, and it's not known how many of these texts existed during the Mahajanapadas period, being the period immediately before and during the time of the Buddha. About 20 brahmanas have survived into modern times. They were seminal in the development of later Indian thought and scholarship, including Hindu philosophy, predecessors of Vedanta, law, astronomy, geometry, linguistics, the concept of karma, stages of life, and so on. Many Brahmanas contain sections that are Aranyakas or Upanishads in their own right. Okay, so just to notice this, we have these different kinds of classes of literatures, like different stages of development, but actually they all overlap. Okay, so we formally distinguish them, but actually they all overlap. And so this, obviously a lot of very important things coming in here, so things like astronomy come in because they have to time the rituals with the different events in the sky and so on. And then geometry becomes very important because the construction of the ritual space has to align with the proper astronomical things and so on. And so each of these ones were developed, branches of learning were developed along with the ritual and so on. So, but the Brahmanas themselves mostly are fairly tedious reading. They're kind of just instructions about the right way to do rituals. Aranyakas are part of the Shruti. These religious texts compose in late Vedic Sanskrit, typical of the Brahmanas and early Upanishads. Indeed, they frequently form part of either the Brahmanas or Upanishads. Aranyaka means belonging to the wilderness, Aranya, from where one cannot see the roofs of the settlement. Oh, that's interesting. So we had all these definitions in the Vinaya. What's a Dharma? What's an Aranya? So here we have a definition from the Aranyakas.
So is it a definition of wilderness?
That's the definition of wilderness, yeah.
Cool. Makes my job
easy.
What? It's the same word. Yeah, Aranya just means forest or wilderness. You cannot see the roofs. That means if you close your eyes, you can't see the roofs. Or if you're inside the house. Okay, they contain Brahmana-style discussion of especially dangerous rituals such as Mahavrata and Pravadgriya, and therefore had to be learned in the wilderness. They have also served as receptacles of later additions to the Vedic corpus. They have nothing to do, as later tradition has it, with sannyasins or vanaprasthas, and they are not of mystical nature, but very close to the brahmanas proper. Okay, so what they're saying here, which is maybe contestable, it looks like it's contested, is whether they're actually to do with the forest renunciate tradition at all, whether they have any connection. What they're saying here is that you go into the secret place to recite them in the quiet, away from people, because it could be too dangerous for other people to overhear them. Yeah? But it's also, it is said, it does talk about to recite and to practice the Vedas, that you go away into the forest into a quiet place where there's no distractions, and then you can recite. So it seems to have a kind of a connection with the idea of meditating in the forest. But so here's the various anikas. So, and then the last one, which we'll be looking at more closely, the Brihararanyaka. Brihad just means really big or powerful or something like that, and Aranyaka is the forest text, and it's an Upanishad. So we mentioned before, Aranyakas and Upanishads, they're not clearly distinguished. It's actually part of the Shatapada Brahmana as well, or considered to be. So it's actually a Brahmana, an Aranyaka, and an Upanishad. So we'll have a bit of a look at that in a minute. So the next, so we have the Sanhita, is the actual collection of Vedic verses, the actual Vedas as such. Brahmana, the ritual verses. Aranyaka, the ones recited in the forest. And the Upanishads. So these are all successive layers, intertwining successive layers of Vedic literature, but these aren't considered as part of the Vedas as such, post-Vedic thought. Okay, the Upanishads are Hindu scriptures that constitute the core teachings of Vedanta. And it's important to note that even though they are regarded in a very central way in the modern Hindu tradition, because of the influence of Shankara around the 7th or 8th century and the founding of Vedanta, it's not at all the case that they were so central before that. And there's little evidence in the Indic tradition that the Upanishads were of central influence before the time of Shankara and the rise of Vedanta. They were there, but they weren't necessarily so important. They do not belong to any particular period of Sanskrit literature. The oldest, such as the Briharanyaka and Chandogya Upanishads, date to the late Brahmana period around the middle of the first millennium BCE. Notice the admirably precise vagueness in the dating, okay? Around the middle first millennium BCE, okay? So it's not too committed. And there's serious dispute as to the date of the Upanishads, and there's some scholars, I think, Bronkhorst, made a serious argument that even the earliest Upanishads, which is the Briharanyaka, were probably composed after the time of the Buddha. But even if they may have some sections after the time of the Buddha, then they seem to be in existence before then. And some of these Upanishads, I think Briharanyaka, Chandogya, and two or three others, are actually referred to in the suttas, in the Tevija Sutta. Okay, well, the latest were composed in the medieval and early modern period. And you find, for example, an Ala Upanishad, obviously from the Muslim period. The Upanishads realized monist ideas, some of which were hinted at in the earlier texts, and they've exerted an important influence on the rest of Hindu and Indian philosophy, and are considered one of the 100 most influential books ever written. Philosopher and commentator Shankara is thought to have composed commentaries on 11 Mukhya or principal Upanishads, those that are generally regarded as the oldest, spanning the late Vedic and Mauryan periods. So for those of you not familiar with Shankara, we'll probably encounter him later in the history of Indian thought, but he's the sort of greatest Hindu commentator, sort of something like the Hindu equivalent of Buddhaghosa. Muktika Upanishad contains a list of 108 canonical Upanishads, with itself as the final one. Okay. So the list says 223 lists of Upanishads. So many, many written over the years, but usually about a dozen or so regarded as the earliest and most authoritative of them. So this one has 18 in this this edition. So anyone who wants to have a look at the Upanishads, this is Radhakrishnan's edition. So this is a very useful one. It has the Sanskrit text, a translation, which is usually quite accurate and quite literal, and quite a lot of comments. He sort of got the text translation and his own comments, which and sometimes he develops his own kind of non-dualistic philosophy, but he also refers to the various Sanskrit commentaries and things like that. So it's quite quite a useful text, that one.
Who's the major Upanishads?
They were accumulated over the years. Certainly the early ones were written, kind of composed in the same sense that the suttas were composed, or similar sense. You have dialogues where characters are named, and then you have sections which may be ascribed to certain sages or whatever, but they're not all composed by one person.
Is there only one single sage?
No.
There's
a series of them. Especially the earliest Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya, are much longer than most of the rest of them, and are obviously a compilation. They're just collections of quite different things with quite different kinds of texts included in them. So they're really just a collection rather than a work as such, whereas the later Upanishads were more somebody sat down and actually wrote, you know, fairly short and coherent text. Yeah. Upanishad derives from upa, ni, and sad, sitting down. Okay, ni sad, upanisidati, sitting down near a teacher in order to receive instruction. Laying siege to the teacher, not particularly useful. In what way?
Well, if there are multiple sources of information, how do you know which source is correct?
You argue about it a lot, and endless days debating it. Yeah, they all approach it in different ways. Yeah, so I mean, typically, I mean, if it's the mainstream tradition, they call the Astika traditions that accept the authority of the Vedas. And yet the Vedas allow so much room for interpretation that that's fairly open-ended. Typically these early Upanishads are regarded as very authoritative. But again, that's Shankara's thing, you know. But they'll also allow authority to much later texts like the Bhagavad Gita and so on as well, Ramayana, which were many hundreds of years later again. So it's not at all simple in that sense. Yeah. But they do acknowledge a difference. For example, the Vedas are all thought to be kind of channeled, sort of a divine channeling kind of thing, which is one of the sources of their authority. Whereas, say, the debates in the Upanishads are more felt to be historical events that happened in a certain period of time. And even in Panini's grammar, they're discussing this, and they say, well, you know, Yajnavalkya is not one of the ancient sages because he didn't live all that long ago, yeah, and so he's one of the Upanishadic sages. So there's a sense in which it's kind of moving towards more historical time, yeah. Alright. So the history of the Upanishads, I'm not sure if it has that here. I mentioned was that they it's quite interesting that they. Yeah, in Darashiko, son of the Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan, translated 50 Upanishads into Persian. Max Müller was aware of 170. So this is quite interesting, because then, so around 1600s-1700s, they translated a lot of the Upanishads into Persian, which is also tells you something about the attitude of the Muslims towards the Indian religion. Obviously, they were quite interested to learn about it. And they, in Persian, then drifted over to Europe and got translated into European languages. And so the first European languages were actually European Upanishads, first knowledge of them was translated from the Persian. later on in the colonial times, then they, the English, of course, got hold of them. They became extremely influential, and very famously, that the most famous one, philosopher who was influenced by them was Schopenhauer, who he said something along the lines of, maybe say it down here. So yeah, here they got the French got them first from the Arabs, and then he got the remaining part, collated the two parts, translated them into French and Latin. So translated from Sanskrit to Persian to Latin. Uppnekhart. The German philosopher Schopenhauer read the Latin translation and extravagantly praised it in his main work. He found that the Upanishads accorded with his own philosophy, which taught the individual as a manifestation of the one basis of reality. So, and then from there became influential in many of the later Western philosophy. I think I've got a quote here. How imbued is every line with firm, definite and harmonious significance. From every page we come across profound, original and sublime thoughts, whilst a lofty and sacred earnestness pervades the whole. It is the most profitable and sublime reading that is possible in the world. It has been the consolation of my life and will be that of my death. So this, I mean, this is marking a major transformation in European thought, yeah? Where instead of regarding the you know, things from the East as being primitive and heretical and so on, and we now have one of the greatest of the Western philosophers who sought such inspiration from the Indian tradition. So here we're seeing one of the very earliest, if not the earliest, time when from a serious Western point of view, that they're actually genuinely seeking spiritual inspiration from the wisdom of the East. Who's Madame de Staël?
She's a relation of mine.
She's a relation of yours? Really? In what way? And oh, she's called Annie. Madame de Staël, French speaking Swiss author. How is she related to you?
Her mother's name is Suzanne Purchard, my mother's name is Patricia Purchard.
Mm-hmm.
And
family. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, very distant. Still related. Anyway, you don't have to do this.
Well, there you go.
She's the daughter of the last Prime Minister of France at the time of the French Revolution. Louis the 18th Finance Minister.
Hmm. Okay. Okay. So there's a thing on the Upanishad. Now we want to go and have a look at the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, but I thought I maybe just break it up a bit by having some Vedic chanting, so we can have a listen to the chants. Because remember that all of these are oral literature, so their experience by the people who are practicing the Emma has to be something that's either chanted or something that's listened to. And one of the things I find interesting is that they still resonate, they still have an impact, and just as they've had an impact in the modern philosophical thought, then we'll have a listen to some ancient and some modern interpretations of some of the Vedic chants. There we go. Is that going to work?
Samaveda, Dautama Sakhayam, Agneyam, Parva Prarabha, Om.
Thank you.
Thai version, Hunter?
Yeah. So that's the Gayatri Mantra. Now here's the text. Om Bhurbhuvasva. And there's a big argument under this particular one. Gayatri Mantra, blah, blah, blah. This is a bad, very bad rendering. Forgive me, the chances sound drunk or have no musical vision. It's like donkeys praying. and then they say basically, if you only hear them from a dualistic mind, but after enlightenment, then it may sound terrific. Why am I ignorant? So here's the argument about it's prohibited. Argument about whether you can do them to music and all of these kinds of things. So this is we were mentioning the other day about the internet discussion groups, and this is the best site on that. Just this has got nothing to do with the Upanishads. So this is Speak Your Brains. And this is a collection of ignorance, narcissism, stupidity, hypocrisy, and bad grammar.
But the tagline, if you love Tommy so much, why don't you go and visit him?
Yeah. And then they collect this. It's from the BBC's site where they collect all these things. And so this is my particular favourite one, this one. This is about the... Sir, if you have young children, it cannot escape your notice just how blatantly the BBC constantly push and promote multiculturalism to our receptive young. With this in mind, imagine my surprise when I sat down with my son a few evenings ago to watch some of the bedtime hour on CBeebies, only to see two white presenters, one male and one female. The huge over-representation of blacks and Asians on children's BBC programmes is already well documented, so I was even more surprised that the lack of an ethnic presenter was not compensated for in some way, as neither of the presenters was obviously homosexual. This evening, I noticed that the female presenter only has one arm. They can't help themselves. These are real. These are real people making these things. So that...
Recently.
Yeah. It's real. So they collect all these kinds of things, yeah. And the one of the nicest things they have here, they got so into this that they made this thing called a Twatotron, which is an automatic random generator of comments on the BBC comment site. Oh look, I heard this week that Prince Philip is banning nursery rhymes. Three words: abolish tax. No doubt this is legal under the EU Human Rights Act, so it's got to deliberately. So they actually get these things, and people will cut them and put them into the BBC site and then see how many positive responses they get from them.
Gotta show black people are helping the Scottish Congress.
Because they want to breed a hybrid species. Come on, stand up and be counted. The last of the, please turn out the light. So they actually sometimes become the most popular ones on BBC because nobody realises that they're there. Anyway, this is entirely beside the point. Right. Okay, so that was the Gayatri Mantra. Where is the Gayatri? There we go. Interpretations. Let us adore the supremacy of the Divine Son, the Godhead, who illuminates all, who recreates all, from all whom all proceed, to whom all must return, who we invoke to direct our understanding aright in our progress towards his holy seat. Okay. Here's another one from the Krishna Yajurveda.
Janantha Janapati Gamhavamahe Kadinka Dinamutamashravatamam
Shanti mantra. Contemporary renditions. This is the Gayatri Mantra. Gayatri Mantra, which we had before. God, thou art the giver of life, and so on. So on, which has. application of it. That's very beautiful. Chant. But this interesting part about this particular chant, it's very hard to translate it, but it has this use of the word dhi, dhimahi, dhiyo. Translation here. So they translate our understanding or our intellect, and our understanding or our thought. But dhi is actually the root for the word we have for jhana. Is dhyana in Sanskrit. So this is the kind of the origins of this kind of idea. It doesn't mean kind of intellect or something. It means more the kind of the inspiration, the kind of the divine inspiration. It means like to direct or raise up our thoughts towards the highest, or raise our mind up towards the highest. Another one. Favourite one. This is the from the Matrix. It's difficult to follow the Sanskrit, but this is the organization. Intelligence, or it's the same word, Buddha, yeah, awakening or intelligence. Yeah. These are different words for knowledge, thought, buddhi. So they've chosen some of the nicest Upanishadic verses here. This literally is like bijate, when broken, is the haraya, the heart bonds, and cut off in at all occasions, at all times. Then when all kamas have come to an end, then is seen paravare. Not quite sure what paravare means. Something then is seen the beyond or the transcendent, something like that. So there we go. A bit of entertainment for today. Okay, so now back to the real world. Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. Is contained within the Shatapatha Brahmana, and its status as an independent Upanishad may be considered a secondary extraction of a portion of the Brahmana text. It makes it one of the old, if not the oldest, texts within the Upanishadic corpus dating to roughly 8th to 7th centuries BCE. That is to say, a few generations before the Buddha, associated with the Shukla Yajurveda. I think I said before it was associated with the Saman Veda, but obviously it was not. It does have hymns to the Saman Veda. Figures as number 10, blah blah blah, and was commented on by Adi Shankara. And so here's the water again. Some of the popular verses, and this is one of the verses we just heard in the music from the Matrix, from lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light, lead us from death to immortality. Shanti, shanti, shanti.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It is. It's a beautiful verse. Yeah. Actually, I noticed that they paraphrased it in the service on for the Victorian bushfires, like in the readings that were being said there. I'm not sure whether it was deliberate or not, but it had the same kind of thing. Oh, from darkness, lead us to the light. Yeah.
The Pali chants don't have the word
Om,
but the Tibetan chants, they use the word Om.
These
Om Malok,
yeah?
Are they from the Hindus?
Yeah. It signifies everything in particular, according to the Hindus. Yeah. And the Brihadaranyaka actually itself goes a lot into that. It's actually, they analyse Om as three phonemes, A, U, M, and each one has a particular meaning, and each one is sort of invested with a very deep philosophical meaning. Yeah. But actually, I think that the original main, the implication of Om, like if you say Om, what happens if you start out, your mouth is open and you're sort of going out into the world, and as you say it, and you're closing your mouth and you're like withdrawing back in. So I think this is really the main implication of it, is that it's a moving back into oneself. Yeah. Probably taken from the Indian scriptures, I'd imagine. Even in Thai Buddhism, it has it as well. Alright. So, the Gretel in text, and that's good. Terrific. Okay, so here's the Sanskrit text. So, Upanishads are a vast and complex literature, so we can't even begin to hope to look at all of them, but maybe just have a look at a few passages that might be of some interest. Okay, so this one is an interesting passage, I think, from a Buddhist point of view, but I'll just read it out to try to get an impression of it. It starts out, this is called the Honey Mantra, the Madhu Vija, Madhu meaning honey. This earth is like honey for all creatures, and all creatures are like honey for this earth. This shining immortal person who is in this earth, and with reference to oneself, this shining immortal person who is in the body, he indeed is just this self. This is immortal, this is Brahman, this is all. This air, this water is like honey for all beings, and all beings are like honey for this water. This shining immortal person who is in this water, and with reference to oneself, this shining immortal person existing as the seed in the body, he indeed is just this self, this immortal, this is Brahman, this is all. This fire is like honey to all beings, and all beings are like honey for this fire. This shining immortal person who is in this fire, and with reference to oneself, this shining immortal person who is made of speech, he is just this self. This is immortal. This is Brahman. This is all. And so it goes through a similar formula. This air, the sun, the quarters, the moon, the lightning, the cloud, the space, the dharma, the truth, the satya. Mankind, manushya, and the self is honey for all beings, and all beings are like honey for the self. This shining immortal person who is in this self, and the shining immortal person who is in this individual self, he is just this self, this is immortal, this is Brahman, this is all. This self verily is the lord of all beings, the king of all beings, just as the spokes are held together in the hub and felly of a wheel, just so in this self all beings, all gods, all worlds, all breathing creatures, all these selves are held together. Right. So I have this kind of suspicion that this particular passage is being referenced in the fire sermon, or at the very least it gives a kind of interesting contrast between the Buddhist approach and the Brahmanical approach. In the Brahmanical approach, everything is honey for everything else. The Buddhist approach, everything is burning. Yeah, eyes burning, sights are burning, eye consciousness is burning, eye contact is burning. It's very kind of similar kind of mantra feel sort of going through the whole thing. Everything is burning. And so you can see here the tendency of the Upanishads. A lot of it tends to be this very, whereas the Buddhism tends to be a negative philosophy, this is not that. And the Upanishads often has this assertive thing, this is that, this is that, this is yourself, this is yourself, this is yourself. But that's not all there is. There's also the opposite tendency found within the Upanishads as well. So this tendency you find here is to identify the self on and on and on. This is yourself, this is yourself, this is yourself, this is yourself, and sort of building it up until everything is yourself. And then finally at the end here, you know, all this is yourself, all Bhuta, Sarva Bhuta, Sarve Deva, Sarve Loka, all worlds, Sarve Prana, Sarvate Atma. These are all included in the self. So again these phrases are very similar to a lot of the phrases you have in say a chant, metta chant, Sarve Bhuta, Sarve Prana, Sarve Satta, Sarve Bhuta, Sarve Prana. And so it's kind of a related, and especially seems this connection between the practice of metta and Brahma Viharas seems to be specially connected with these kinds of phrasings.
So what do you mean by the Buddhist with the burning things, like fire and burning, and Brahma, what well.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
Well,
I was referring to the second Buddhist, the Buddha's third discourse he gave to this group of fire worshipping ascetics. And because they're fire worshipping ascetics, then they're obviously practicing within that Vedic tradition of worshipping Agni. And so they're probably used to this kind of Agni, the fire, yeah. So they're probably used to this kind of verses, yeah. And so the Buddha's pointed out that so it's the discourse on dukkha, yeah, on suffering, yeah. The eye is burning, forms are burning, eye consciousness is burning, eye contact is burning, the feeling that arises dependent on them all is burning. What's it burning with? It's burning with the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. Yeah. And so the Buddha's sort of pointing to it, to that, to turning away from those things which are not peaceful.
So when you're Hindu, you know, about self, you know, and universal.
Ah, well, that's a matter for, it depends who you ask. Yeah? If you ask a Buddhist, they'll say the content is completely different. If you ask a Hindu, they'll say it's just the same but with different wording.
Of course.
Yeah.
Mm. But they don't mention about impermanence of I or self, soul.
Let's have a look more, and let's have a look at some more texts and see what they actually say. Transcendentalism, yeah.
I really wanted to just check
in
before you move, but I mean, it's okay.
I'm not sure. Okay, let me have a look at that briefly. There's on here, I think. They had this one down the bottom, the criticism. Is this the one you were looking for?
Yeah.
Okay. The Upanishadic thinkers came to consider change as a mere illusion because it could not be reconciled with a permanent and homogeneous reality. They were therefore led to a complete denial of plurality. So in this, there's obviously a conflict going on and a dialogue going on between the Upanishadic, not necessarily the Upanishads, but the philosophers descending from that, with the Buddhists. Okay? And so the Buddhists believed that change was real.
Plurality.
Yeah. Again, this is specifically combating with the, especially the Abhidhamma Buddhism. So Abhidhamma Buddhism held that change is real, that reality is not permanent and homogenous, and that plurality is real. That means that there's a genuine diversity of things in the world. Whereas there's an absolute differences between things in the world. This is the Abhidhamma philosophy. Yeah? Not necessarily the early Buddhist philosophy, but the Abhidhamma philosophy. So the Upanishads. What?
There's absolute change in. Because change is, once change is, there's absolute difference.
Yeah, except that, that Abhidhamma philosophy was precisely what was criticized by a lot of the Mahayana philosophers, especially Nagarjuna. So Nagarjuna and some others tried to find a middle way there between absolute diversity and absolute unity. And remembering that the Buddha said, absolute diversity is one extreme, absolute unity is another extreme, I teach dependent origination. There's the middle way. Dependent origination. Yeah? Well, we'll have a look more at these things later on. This is about the later Indian philosophy. According to David Kalupahana, who's one of the greatest modern philosophers in discussion of this, he's kind of from the post-Wittgenstein kind of school of Buddhist hermeneutics. Although the search for an essential unity of things was crowned with success, philosophy suffered a severe setback as a result of this transcendentalism. Paul Dusan wrote on this unity, this unity excluded all plurality and therefore all proximity in space, all succession in time, all interdependence in cause and effect, and all opposition as subject and object. According to Kalupahana, reality was considered to be beyond space, time, change, and therefore causality. Change is a mere matter of words, nothing but a name. After this, metaphysical speculation took the upper hand, and any serious attempt to give a rational explanation of the things of experience is lacking in the Upanishads. So this is a philosophical critique. Dalit activist and Buddhist convert Ambedkar contended that the philosophy of the Upanishads turned out to be the most ineffective and inconsequential piece of speculation with no effect on the moral and social order of the Hindus.
But how is this different for emptiness?
Thinking similar things.
Yeah, well, that's a subtle matter, but we'll have a look at that as we go.
We can give a vote to that. Hindus think that our approach is different, you know?
That's easier, isn't it? Yeah.
Buddhist conceptions of emptiness similar to just that lack of worrying about the messiness of life. That's kind of transcends Hinduism.
Yeah. I think Buddhism can go over to that, or some Buddhist philosophy can go over to that kind of extreme, but it doesn't necessarily have to. I mean, remembering that when Nagarjuna talked about emptiness, he said that it is dependent origination. So, and if you listen to certainly the Tibetan philosophers, that's Bangor, let's keep that similar idea. They say that it's not that emptiness doesn't mean that things don't exist. It just means that they don't exist in and of themselves.
In an intrinsic way.
Yeah, they don't inherently exist. Yeah. Sorry? For Paticca Samuppada?
No.
Sunyata? Emptiness?
No. Anything existing in
and of itself. Ah, Svabhava. Sabhava. Sabhava, yeah. Okay, so here's some of the critiques. So some of them are philosophical critiques, some of them are practical critiques. It's not. Ambedkar's criticism here is not necessarily cogent, in the sense that the non-dual philosophy isn't meant to be a moral and social philosophy. It's meant to be a speculative metaphysics on the nature of reality, and so the fact that it hasn't had effect on moral and social order, whether that's true or not, but that doesn't necessarily mean the philosophy is wrong. It just means that's not its purpose. Okay, so then there's quite a lot of dialogues following this with the Ajñāvalkya, and he's the by far the most important sage in this period, and I think probably the most important of all of the pre-Buddhist Indian philosophers. And so I'll just have a bit of a look at some of the dialogues that feature Ajñāvalkya. Okay, so this is an interesting one. This is a dialogue between Ajñāvalkya and Gargi Vachaknavi, Gargi being a woman. And so interesting that we're being told again and again in Buddhism that Brahmanism was so biased against women and that they didn't have any part in the spiritual life, but Brahmanical texts don't entirely support that idea. Gargi Vachaknavi asked him, Ajñāvalkya, since all this here is woven like warp and woof in water, on what, pray, is water woven like warp and woof? So this, she's asking a question that's relating to the weaving, yeah? And interesting that as a woman she's asking about one of the classic women's crafts is the weaving. And so this is the idea of what is the word world woven out of or woven into. And again, this idea of everything interpenetrating. And so what's water woven? Water's woven on air. And what is air woven on the worlds of the sky? And what is the worlds of the sky woven on the worlds of the Gandharvas? The worlds of the Gandharvas are woven on the worlds of the sun. The worlds of the sun are woven on the worlds of the moon. The worlds of the moon are woven on the worlds of the stars. The worlds of the stars are woven on the worlds of the devas. The worlds of the devas are woven on the worlds of Indra. The worlds of Indra are woven on the worlds of Prajapati. the worlds of Prajapati are woven on the worlds of Brahma. And then what are the worlds of Brahma woven on? Okay? Now here's the real question. What is the Brahma Loka woven on? In warp, like warp and woof. Here Yajnavalkya said, Gargi, do not question too much, lest your head fall off. Verily, you are questioning too much about the divinity about which we are not to ask too much.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, do not, Gargi, question too much. Yeah.
Is this a Catholic text? Or?
No, we find a similar thing in Buddhism. It's kind of pressing towards Nibbana, and then says about Nibbana, it says, well, look, you're proliferating about the unproliferated. Yeah? There's a limit to questions. So, Mati Prakshi. That's quite a nice little one. Gargi kept silent. Okay. And then they have another series of questions. And it's interesting that they actually have a group of Brahmins there, all trying to defeat Yajnavalkya in debate. And the last one, the final question, who's trying to defeat him, is again Gargi. So she's not just one of the people taking part in the debate, she's actually like the final one who challenges him, and she says, Venerable Prince tells to the other Brahmins, 2, 3, 8.1, okay, I'm going to ask him two questions. If he answers me these, none of you can defeat him in answers about Brahman. Okay, so that's quite a she's making quite a claim there, yeah? That she can give him the hardest questions of all. And then she says, then she begins, as a warrior son of the Khasis or the Videhas might rise up against you, having strung his unstrung bow and having taken in his hand two pointed foe-piercing arrows. Even so, O Yajnavalkya, do I face you with two questions? Pretty full, isn't it? Okay. We were talking the other day about the debate and the nature of the debate in ancient India. So obviously they're pretty serious about it. Okay, so the first one, again, it's similar to what she was asking before. Yajnavalkya, of which they say, it is above the heaven, beneath the earth, that which is between the two, the heaven and the earth, that which the people call the past, the present, and the future, across what is that woven, like warp and woof? Okay, and then Yajnavalkya's answer is, that is all woven across space. Okay, and so she says, all right, you got me there. That's a good answer. Here's the next one. And, oh yeah, there's a problem here, isn't there? I'm just trying to think. It says, above the heaven, beneath the earth, which is between the two, the heaven and earth, that which people call the past, present, and future, across what is that woven? Oh, okay, and then across what is space woven? Okay, so everything in the world, the past, present, and future, is built on space. So again, this idea of space as an absolute, whereas in Buddhism, space is relative. Space is just the gap between the elements. So what then is space woven upon? Right? So the Yajnavalkya's answer here. Okay, the knowers of Brahman, call the imperishable aksharam. The aksharam, the imperishable, they call aksharam. This is a very important word, very interesting word in the Indic and Upanishadic philosophy. Akshara is also the word, or akara is also the word for a phoneme. Okay, so it's the smallest unit that you can break language down to. Okay, so you can take sentences and break them down into words. You can take words and break them down into syllables. You can take syllables, you break them down into phonemes. Yeah? It's the smallest unit that you can possibly have in language. And so this is an akshara, and it's used in the sense of something that's imperishable. It's an atomic kind of idea. You can't break it down any further. So, and the akshara or the akshara, the imperishable, is also the Brahman. They call the imperishable. It's astulang and anuvavang. Astulang and anu. Keep spelling here. It's neither gross nor fine, neither short nor long, neither red like fire nor adhesive like water. It's neither shadow nor is it darkness, neither air nor space, unattached, sangam, without taste, without smell. There seems to be a different reading here. Rasam. It's a different reading than I've got in my text here. Without taste, without smell, without eyes, without ears, without voice, without mind, without radiance. None of those are on here. Without breath, without a mouth, without measure. This is probably a matrang here. Without measure, with no inner and no outer. So quite a few extra terms in the Radhakrishna's text here. Oh, sorry, I missed the line. Sorry, you're quite right. Sorry, my fault. Okay, unattached, that's right. Without taste, without smell, without eye, without ear, without voice, without thought. So on. Okay, sorry. Okay, so that's sounding quite interesting then, isn't it? Yeah? So we've gone all the way from everything in the world and past, present and future and all the worlds to space. And then what's space built on? Well, space is built on what is not big, not long, not small, not eye, not ear, not in between, not outer, not measured. Yeah? Having no within out, it eats nothing and nothing eats it. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is kind of very Buddhist, and you can actually find quite close parallels to this in descriptions of Nibbana in the suttas. Yeah. There's no long, there's no short, there's no dark, there's no bright, there's no inner, there's no outer, all of these things. And this part at the end here is very important. It doesn't eat anything and nothing eats it. Okay, so this is saying that it's not dependent, because eating is a sign of dependence. It's a sign of being involvement in the world of conditionality. And so this is entirely separate from that. It's not involved in the world at all. And there's another verse here. No, he keeps going, right. Right. Verily, at the command of that imperishable, this Gargi, the sun and the moon stand in their respective positions. At the command of that imperishable, the heaven and earth stand in their respective permissions. At the command of that imperishable, what are called moments, hours, days, nights, half-months, months, seasons, years stand in their respective positions. At the command of the imperishable, some rivers flow to the east from the snowy mountains, some to the west. At the command of the imperishable, men praise those who give. The gods are desirous of the sacrificer and the fathers are desirous of the Darvi offering. Whoever Gargi in this world, without knowing this imperishable, so here obviously is the difference between the conception of Nibbana and this conception of Brahman. Okay, so with the Buddhists, the conception of Nibbana, it is really like nothing eats it and it doesn't eat anything, so it doesn't actually participate in the world in any way. And so this, of course, is the problem, that once you've defined something as having no attributes and no qualities, then how does it involve itself with the world? But in their Brahmanical conception, it's completely fundamental. So the world is all woven in this thing, and it actually commands everything. And then this is also very interesting. Whoever, without knowing this akshara, aviditva, not knowing. And this is this phrase which you find again and again and again and again through the Vedas, and especially the Upanishads, ya evang veda, who knows this? Okay? And so it's all about the knowing. When you're doing the ritual, when you're doing the chanting, when you're doing the philosophy, whatever you're doing, who knows this? Yeah? And so it's all about the subjective understanding of it. Who, without knowing this, performs sacrifices, worships, performs austerities for 1,000 years, his work will have an end. Whosoever, without knowing this imperishable, departs from the world is pitiable. Okay? So if you don't know it, whatever you do the austerities and everything, you're pitiable. But if you do know this, you depart from the world, then you're a Brahman. So you're a true knower, you're basically enlightened, knower of Brahman. Verily, that imperishable, O Gargi, is unseen, but is the seer, is unheard, but is the seer, is unthought, but is the thinker, is uncognized, but is the cognizer. There is no seer but this, there is no hearer but this, there is no thinker but this, there is no knower but this. By this imperishable, O Gargi, is space woven like warp and woof. Okay, so here, having come back from a cosmic interpretation of the Brahman, he comes coming back to an individual or a psychological interpretation. It's the inner knowing which underlies all experience. So this idea, the unseen seer, unheard hearer, unthought thinker, uncognized cognizer, this phrase, the dipta, sutta, mutta and vijñāta, we find constantly throughout the Buddhist scriptures. Okay, obviously is derived from a similar idiom. In this case, just as a technical interpretation here, the word mata definitely means thought in the past participle, what has been thought. Mata in Sanskrit, mutta in Pali. But the Pali commentators interpret it not as thought, but as what is not the other senses. So it's not seen and heard, it's what's smelt, tasted and touched. And that's clearly a misunderstanding. It's one of the many points of interpretation which show that Pali commentators weren't actually aware of the Upanishads. If they had been, they would have known what that meant. So you've got to admit, he gives a pretty good answer. Well, I think it's pretty good anyway.
How could the commentators be not aware of?
Well, exactly, yeah. Good point. Yeah, but it's almost certain that they're not. Yeah, but also as I mentioned, that the Upanishads were not necessarily that well known in the Indic tradition until the time of Shankara, which was after the time of the commentators. Yeah, but I mean the Buddha was aware of them. Yeah, look, it just seems that the Buddhists became self-involved. They only studied their own scriptures, and because they were so dismissive of the Brahmanical scriptures, they didn't actually study them anymore. And so they didn't know when the Buddha was referring to the Upanishadic idioms and so on. They just simply didn't get it. And you constantly find that, you know, if you read especially the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, you're constantly finding similes, language, terms and so on that's used in the suttas. And it really clarifies a lot of context, like they say, the understanding of nama rupa, all kinds of things. Yeah. Even like idioms like this famous idiom of the Buddha being held, strapped together like cart. You know that one when he was nearly dying and his body was like an old cart that's strapped together? That's also found in the Upanishads. And constantly you find them. Okay, Gargi then said, Venerable Brahmanas, you may think it a great thing if you get out of this just by bowing to him. Not one of you will defeat him in arguments about Brahman. And then she kept silent. So, okay. Yep. Yep. Well, yeah, this is what empiricists would criticise this kind of philosophizing for. It's not based on reality, so yeah, you can keep doing that. You know, mine's more transcendental and more out there than yours. But you can also see it in terms of an evolution. You know, it becomes meaningful when you see it in terms of an evolution of understanding. So, for example, like this emphasis at the end that, you know, if you actually understand the nature of these things, then this is more powerful than the ritual. So it's what he's saying at the end. You know, you can do all the rituals without understanding anything, but it's actually your understanding which is more important than the ritual. So it's a sort of an evolution from in that way.
Is there also a possibility that through this action on the basis of these negative experiences, say, the former jhanas, you go from the space to
Absolutely, yeah. There seems to be a, you know, when we looked at the Buddha's life story, it has these rishis who, you know, seem to be doing formless jhanas. You also have in the Solasapanhara of the Suttanipata this conversation with these Brahmanical rishis, and again it mentions the formless attainments quite a few times. And those particular verses are very close to the Upanishads and contain quite a lot of references and quotes to them. So it seems likely that in this kind of language that you're talking about the same similar cultural environment where at the very least the philosophy is influenced by those kinds of attainments, yeah. Even though you don't find like clear and distinct descriptions of the meditation attainments like you find in Buddhism. Yeah. So whether Yajnavalkya himself or at least he's participating in that kind of environment. Yeah.
Did Gargi ever...
Oui. Not against Yajnavalkya. Yeah. So this is an interesting one, a little bit further on. He then has more of a conversation with a fellow called Shakalya. And 3.9.26. He goes. Okay, again, it comes to a similar kind of space. He keeps on asking more and more questions, and then... 3.9.26. On what are you and your... What is you and yourself supported on the prana? What is the prana supported? It's the in, and then on the apana is the out-breath, or in-breath and out-breath. And what's the... Apana supported on the Vyana, the diffused breath, and this is supported on the Udana, the upgoing breath. And upgoing breath, these are just different kinds of conceptions of the breath energies in the body. Yeah. And what's that supported on? The Samana is the all-pervading breath. And what is samadhi? That self is not this. It's a neti, neti. This is one of the most famous sayings of Yajnavalkya. Neti, neti. Yeah? Neti. Not this, not this. No. And so he's regarded as one of those sages who introduced that perspective into the tradition. So the more characteristic way of saying this is that, yourself is this, yourself is this. So always affirming everything. And Yajnavalkya says, not this, it's not this. It is incomprehensible. For it is never comprehended, it's like it's never grabbed, it's never apprehended. It's indestructible, for it's never destroyed. It is unattached, for it does not attach. Sajite. It is unfettered, it does not suffer, it is not injured. There are these eight abodes, eight worlds, eight gods, the eight persons. He who takes apart and puts together these persons and passes beyond them, that is the person taught in the Upanishads about whom I ask you. If you do not explain him to me, your head will fall off. Okay, so again this threat which Yajnavalkya issues to Shakalya, and again you find this quite frequently in the suttas, this idea that people's head's going to fall off, and that's actually found in the Parayanavagga and the Solasapanhara and the Suttanipata as well, similar context. Except... In Buddhism, because Buddhism is kind of nice, the heads don't actually roll in Buddhism, Shakalya did not know him and his head fell off. The robbers took away his bones thinking they were something else. Alright? So, Tasaha Murja Vivapata. So And also the relationship, interesting little kind of details, that kind of relationship with material things. And he has this nice question here. Janaka, the king of Videha, was seated to give audience. So Janaka, the king of Videha, is an area in part of the Vajjian Republic, and he was probably a real king. There's still an existing Janakpur in the area today, and he's also mentioned in the Jatakas. So he was probably a real king in that area, who was part of, you know, the kind of, the, used to enjoy debating with sages and so on, remembered both in the Upanishads and the Jatakas. He was seated to give audience. Yajnavalkya came up. Janaka said to him, Yajnavalkya, For what purpose have you come? Wishing for cattle or for subtle questions? Yajnavalkya said to him, for both, Your Majesty. So you can see this kind of real character underneath there. You know? He's obviously got a sense of humour. And then the... So many interesting things in here. Has these kind of similes, a simile of the cart. Just as a heavily loaded cart moves creaking, even so the self in this body, mounted by the self of intelligence, moves creaking when one is breathing with difficulty and when one's about to die. There's a simile from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And then the very next verse, when this body becomes thin, whether he gets to thinness through old age or disease, just as a mango or a fig or a fruit of the Bodhi tree, the people tree, releases itself from its bond, even so this person frees himself from these limbs and returns again as he came to the place from which he started back to new life. And again, that exactly the same simile is found at the end of the Brahmajala Sutta, the mango detaching itself from its stalk. Okay, and another simile here. Just as a leech or a caterpillar, when it's come to the end of a blade of grass, having made another blade of grass, made approach the other grave glass, draws itself together towards it, so does this self, having thrown away this body and dispelled ignorance, having approached another body, draws itself together to the other body. And there's a nice verse here, which I quite like. Into blind darkness enter they who worship ignorance. Into greater darkness than that enter those who delight in knowledge. So here, yeah. See, this is part of the criticism of like just the kind of the intellectual knowledge, yeah, the intellectual knowledge of the ritual and the text and things like that, not the real knowledge of the self. So, okay, now I'll go on to the debate or dialogue with the missus. Now then, Yajnavalkya had two wives, Maitreyi and Katyayani. Of the two, Maitreyi was a discourse on Brahma knowledge, while Katyayani possessed only such knowledge as women have. Now then, Yajnavalkya, when he wished to get ready for another mode of life, said to his wife Maitreyi, "Verily, I'm getting away from this state into the forest. I'm going to go forth." She has this. It's interesting. Let's see if I can find it here. Okay, so he said, "I'm going to go forth, Pravajan, Pravajisan, from this place. Okay, now let me make a settlement with you and Katyayani." Then Maitreyi said, "My lord, if indeed this whole earth filled with wealth were mine, would I become immortal by that or not?" Okay, this whole world, Sarva Pratavi, is filled with wealth. Would I become Amrita? Yajnavalkya said, "No, Nedi. As the life of people who have plenty of things will be your life, but there's no hope of immortality through wealth." Then Maitreyi said, "What shall I do with that by which I do not become immortal? Venerable sir, please explain the way to immortality for me." And Yajnavalkya said, "Before you've been dear to me, and now you've even dearer. Therefore, if you wish, my dear, I will explain it to you. As I'm explaining to you, please meditate or consider that." Again, here the word "here" is from the same root as dhyana, and it means to contemplate deeply. Yajnavalkya said, "Verily, not for the sake of the husband is the husband dear, but for the sake of the self is the husband dear. Not for the sake of the wife is the wife dear, but for the sake of the self is the wife dear. Verily, not for the sake of sons are the sons dear, not for the sake of wealth, not for the sake of cattle, not for the sake of the Brahmana or the Kshatriya or the worlds or the gods or the Vedas or the beings, or even the all, but for the sake of the self is all dear. Okay. Again, this kind of list, sort of moving through kind of the different sort of realms and sort of starting with the mundane and working up to the kind of the gods and so on, and ending with the all, it sounds very similar to some of the suttas, like say the Mulapariyaya Sutta, and it has a similar kind of pattern. Verily, Maitreya, the self is to be seen, to be heard, seen, to be heard, to be reflected on, to be contemplated. When the self is seen, heard, reflected on, and known, then all of this is known. So when you know the self, Drista, Sutta, Mutta, Vijñāta, the same set, then Idam, Sarvam, Viditam, all of this is known. So Noah is this constant subjectivity about him. Then it goes the next verse. Brahmanhood deserts him who knows Brahmanhood in anything but the self. Being Kshatriya, the worlds, the gods, the Vedas, beings, everything deserts one who knows all in anything else but the self. All of these things, all of them are the self. Sarvam yam yadayam atma. Just as when a drum is beaten, one cannot grasp the external sounds, but by grasping the drum or the beater of the drum, the sound is grasped. Okay, so again, these similes found in the suttas. Just as when a conch is blown, one cannot grasp the external sound, but by grasping the conch or the blower of the conch, the sound is grasped. This one again found very similar form in the suttas. It talks about the kind of foolish people who they hear the sound of the conch, a man blowing a conch shell, and then they try to get it and then say, where is the sound in the shell? I can't see where it is. Just as when a lute is played, one cannot grasp the external sounds, but by grasping the lute or the player, the sound is grasped. As from a fire kindled with damp fuel, various kinds of smoke issue forth, so verily from this great being, this Mahato Bhutashya, from this great being has been breathed forth that which is the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Saman Veda, and the Himsi Yatharvans, and the Angirasas, the Itihasa, Purana. Again, these are kinds of literature mentioned in the suttas, the itihasas mentioned in the suttas, puranas, and so on. Ancient laws, sciences, sacred teachings, verses, aphorisms, explanations, commentaries, sacrifice, oblation, food, drink, this world, the other, and all beings. From it indeed have all this been breathed forth. And it kind of goes on quite a lot in the similar kind of vein. So just as the ocean is the one goal, the meeting place of all waters. And so this is a passage I referred to in History of Mindfulness, where it has the ekayana, the use of the word ekayana. And just as the skin is the one goal of all kinds of touch, the nose is the one goal of the meeting place of all smells, the tongue is the meeting place of taste, the eye is the meeting place of forms, and so on and so on and so forth. So this seems to me clearly what ekayana means in a philosophical context, is the place where everything comes together. So this is what the phrase is found in the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. The Satipatthana is the ekayana magga, so the path to where everything comes together as one. That's how I interpret it. Again, this being a case where the commentaries in the later Buddhist tradition just clearly did not know about these passages and didn't know what the implications were. Okay. Oh, they give a whole list of different interpretations. So in the commentary, it gives about four or five interpretations. Ekayana means the one and only way. It means the way which you go alone. Yeah. It means the way which leads to the one, where the one is described as Nibbana. And so different interpretations. And then in the Chinese, it also gives a whole host of other different interpretations. And it's not at all arbitrary to say that the Buddhist use harks from the Brahmanical use, because the word ekayana is actually found most commonly in the mouth of Brahma. in the Sagatavada, it's actually Brahma who comes down to the Buddha and who uses that term in the context of the Satipatthana. So it's actually explicitly placed within the Brahmanical tradition by the Buddhist texts. As a mass of salt is without inside, without outside, is together a mass of taste, again reminding us of the salt in the great ocean, the Buddha said, is all the taste of liberation. Even so, verily, is this self without inside, without outside, altogether a mass of intelligence or only, an entire mass of prajna, it says, of knowing, gana, kritsna. This is the word Krishna, means complete or fulfilled. This is actually the root of the word we know in Buddhism as kasina. So you talk about kasina meditation, and we think of a kasina as a disc. Yeah? So this is what they say a kasina is a disc like that, which you sit in front and you meditate on, the colour, or the mood of it, or whatever. And I meditate on that one, thanks. And then sometimes I feel a bit more like doing that one. And that's what a kasina is. But actually the meaning of kasina is what's here, is of a totality. It's a complete totality of consciousness. And that's exactly how it's used in the suttas itself. It says, one contemplates the earth, kasina, above, below, around, immeasurable, non-dual, advayam, a complete totality of the earth. Right? So it's referring to a meditative absorption based on the contemplation. It's not referring to a physical object. Oh, and I should have mentioned also again that we're noticing so many correlations between this particular text and the Buddhist texts, but not only are the details the same, but the very debate, if in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, he notes that this very conversation between Yajnavalkya and Maitreyi is actually probably the model for one of the debates in the suttas between, or conversations between Pasenadi and his wife Mallika, where they debate about the self. Yeah? Who is most valuable to you, the self? And so there's probably some influence there. Okay. So, without insight altogether, a mass of consciousness, prajñāna ghanameva. This dialogue is extremely important within this Upanishad. It actually appears twice, and there's certain differences between them. And in the other version of it, it doesn't say prajñāna, it actually says vijñāna. Vijñāna ghanameva. Sorry? Yeah. It means what you want to make it to mean, but I think what it's meaning is that the world only has a value because of its sacredness or its holy aspect. And so everything that we do in our lives has like a contingent value. But it actually only has an absolute value in terms of its context within the spiritual path. Something like that. Yeah, it's used in a Buddhist sense of self, then, yeah. It's about the question of metta.
But in terms of,
and that's the way that the Buddhist adaptation of it is. Yeah, and so here within the Upanishad it's always given that metaphysical implication, but within the Buddhist adaptation it's sort of taking the language, but not necessarily having the same implications for it. In each case, it's a religious experience. Yeah. Yeah. It's not necessarily whether it's sacred or not, but whether it has that metaphysical implication.
Is it about the way that we're
I think the difference would be in the Buddhist way that you stick more closely to just the experience as it happens. So, you know, you say it's the way to lead to oneness, and you say, well, it's an experience of oneness, and so you don't further then take the next philosophical step of assuming, because I've had this very profound experience of oneness, therefore the entire universe is actually just oneness. And so that's the step which Buddhists wouldn't take. Well, some Buddhists wouldn't take. Alright? Okay. Having arisen out of these elements, the self vanishes again into them. Okay? When he's departed, there is no more sanya. Now, this is a interesting passage which is a bit controversial. Napretya sadnya. And so sometimes is interpreted as saying that Yajnavalkya didn't believe in life after death. Okay, after death there's no more consciousness, there's no more awareness. But the traditional understanding, which I think is probably correct, understands sanya more in the sense of the Buddhist understanding. Sanya is like you don't have this kind of, for an enlightened person, they don't have like a separative consciousness, or they don't have like the kind of ordinary working of conventional consciousness, but they just have the sheer mass of awareness. Difficult, not using exactly the same sense, but probably in a similar sense. Yeah, I think it means kind of like a kind of a more limited ways of knowing things in terms of concepts. Yeah. I think that's what Yajnavalkya is saying. I think not from Buddhist concept, no. Then Maitreya said, "Here indeed, Venerable Sir, you have caused me to reach utter bewilderment. Indeed, I do not at all understand this self." Okay? So again, this is similar. You find this same thing in Buddhist scriptures, that people listen to what the Buddha said and they said, I just don't get it, what are you talking about? So I do not vijanami. And then he said, I do not say anything bewildering, nothing moham. Yeah? This self, verily, is imperishable and of indestructible nature. For where there is a duality, dvaitam, okay, so this is where the idea of non-dual comes, then where there is duality, as it were, there one sees the other, one smells the other, one tastes the other, one speaks to the other, one hears the other, one thinks of the other, one touches the other, one knows the other. But where everything has become just one's own self, by what and whom should one see? By what and whom should one smell? By what and whom should one taste? By what and to whom should one speak? By what and whom should one hear? By what and of whom should one think? By what and whom should one touch? By what and whom should one know? By what should one know him by whom all this is known? That self is described as not this, not this. And here's the neti neti again, this phrase. Neti neti. Sa esa neti netyatma. So these are the most important phrases here, by which all this is cognized. Who can cognize that? He is incomprehensible, because he cannot be comprehended, indestructible, cannot be destroyed, unattached. Again, we've meeting the same phrase we met before. He does not suffer, he's not injured. By what would you know the knower? Thus you have the instruction given to you, the anusasana. O Maitreya, such verily is the deathless. Having said this, Yajnavalkya went off into the forest. Sorry? So another similarity to Buddhism, that they both abandoned their wives.
No, it's easy to me. I'm totally confused about the forest here.
Yeah.
personal consciousness.
For who?
For ordinary people, like human beings.
What do you mean, in the Upanishads or in Buddhism or anything like that? No, no, no. There's Buddhism and consciousness is precisely that which links life to life.
Is that another spirit theory, Monty? Isn't that just another way of saying self, consciousness?
What do you think?
This Dhamma is dependently originated, Monty. In the presence of this, there's that. There's not this agent, consciousness, self, spirit, me, I.
I think because last time when I asked the same question, you mentioned that consciousness is nothing but we are aware.
Yeah.
Hmm. And then after that, you be saying that there's consciousness that is, life to life.
Yeah.
But where is this awareness come?
What do you mean, where does the awareness come?
Well, what is it working on?
Can you ask the question more clearly?
After that, the mind and body is always together. I remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So
not necessarily the mind and the body in this sense of this physical body, but there's always a physical dimension to experience.
So I understand that. After the death, there is a subtle body that contains this awareness of mind, and you can call it as a consciousness.
So, can you say it again?
If you believe that after the
death,
after the death, there is still this subtle body which is going, like, body, heaven body itself, and there is a consciousness.
Yeah.
So then, even after death, there is something in this thing, like there's a physical form.
Uh-huh.
Is that right?
Yeah.
And that's the same when you mention about consciousness.
Uh-huh. When we say consciousness, it's just the word consciousness is used frequently in the suttas for the kind of the stream of consciousness which flows on from one life to another and these kinds of ideas. But the suttas also talk about it in different ways. Like sometimes they say it's the five khandhas, sometimes they say it's nama rupa. So it's not trying to say that there's just consciousness alone, but consciousness performs a special function, because consciousness is precisely what they're talking about here, is the unknown, unseen seer, the unknown knower, the unheard hearer. Yeah? It's the one which actually receives all the information. That's what consciousness is.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it's not regarded as being permanent and eternal, as the Upanishads are putting it, but itself is conditioned. Okay?
Yeah.
So it's conditioned precisely by that information which is being fed to it. The sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and some thoughts. Yeah? These are things which are conditioning consciousness. Yeah? And which the things, in our mind, we're always reacting to these things, and reaction to it is making karma, and karma is the energy that keeps the process going.
Yeah?
Yeah? So that process keeps unfolding after one's died. No. Theravada has a concept they call the Bhavanga, Bhavanga Chitta, which in some ways performs a similar role to the Alaya Vijnana. And in fact, in Vasubandhu, says that the Alaya Vijnana and the Vibhanga Chitta are the same. Okay, so Vasubandhu explicitly says that the Bhavanga Chitta of the Theravadins, meaning specifically the Sri Lankan Theravadins, and the Alaya Vijnana, and also the thing they call the Mula Vijnana of the Mahasanghikas. These were all different words for the same thing. Now, in fact, they're not. He was being a bit disingenuous, or perhaps he didn't know the theory all that well, because they're not actually exactly the same. The Bhavanga Chitta, the idea of the Bhavanga Chitta is that Bhavanga happens when nothing else is happening. Okay, you have a moment of hearing. When that hearing process is finished, the mind sort of lapses into this kind of stream of what they call Bhavanga. And originally, that's actually all Bhavanga was. It was just a way of saying, well, there's a kind of minimal conscious process which continues in between active times of consciousness. And it's really just a gap filler. It's something that you stick in there to sort of fix, to provide continuity. Whereas Alaya Vijnana, in a sense, is supposed to not be in between the other things, but like underneath them. Yeah, so the Alaya Vijnana is conceived as being underneath all the other moments of consciousness.
Is this where you can get the original mind idea coming from?
Exactly, the original mind.
Or the
idea.
Buddha mind and Buddha nature,
yeah.
And these sorts of ideas.
And those ideas also influence the interpretation of the Bhavanga Chitta. And they influence Buddha Gosa. So it's precisely at that point that Buddha Gosa himself was influenced by Asanga and by the Yogacara interpretation. He commented on this. There's this teaching in the suttas. It talks about the original, not the original mind, the radiant mind. And it says this mind is radiant and then is defiled by defilements that come in. Therefore, the noble disciple knows what development of mind, of meditation is. So it's actually a sutta about development of meditation. If you develop your mind in meditation, it becomes radiant, the defilements leave it. And there's no suggestion that it means the natural mind or the, you know, inherently radiant or any of those kinds. They're not suggested in the text at all. When Buddha Gosa comments on it, he includes the word pakati, which means naturally. The mind is naturally radiant. Yeah? And instead of talking about it in the context of meditation, which it explicitly was, it was in the context of chitta bhavana, he talks about it as the bhavanga chitta. And that in that, he was... His precursor for that was a particular Mahayana sutra called the Lankavatara Sutta, which was introduced to Sri Lanka as a Mahayana text. It actually means the invasion of Sri Lanka, okay, the Lankavatara Sutra. And it was introduced as a means of converting the Theravadins. And so one of the doctrines in that particular text was this idea of the mind as being naturally radiant. So it evolved in the Yogacara school, was brought to Sri Lanka a generation or two before Buddha Gosa, and then he was influenced by that in his comment on there. That process was shown by David Kalabahana. We met him before in the comments on the Upanishads. Yeah, so he was the one who did that research.
So the idea that everybody has a Buddha nature, is it from the Theravadis or the later
sectarian
Buddhist schools?
The idea of the Buddha nature as such, Tathagata Garbha, I think, is a Yogacara development. I believe. Yeah. Although, but Tathagata Garbha doesn't actually mean Buddha nature. In the Indic version, it means Tathagata means Buddha, and the Garbha means an embryo. Yeah. So it means that everyone has the potential or the capacity for being a Buddha. Right? Like a seed of Buddhahood. Doesn't mean that you already are Buddhas. Yeah. But I mean, so it's a kind of, that's also a question of interpretation. But it's certainly, it's not against the Theravadin teachings to think that everybody has the innate capacity for awakening. You know, that's inherent, I think, in all the Buddhist traditions. Yeah.
It's more about the concept that there's an underlying agent.
Exactly,
which
yeah.
Is where I think Theravada would have a problem.
Yeah,
there's this thing called Buddha nature that sort of like sits in your little thumb and it sort of activates every lifetime, just going from lifetime to lifetime, just waiting for you to develop patterns or something.
So speaking of the little thumb, yeah, you do have that idea of the self as the man is the size of the little thumb that's in the Upanishads as well.
What is the differences?
Well, one of the key differences we already noticed before is that the Brahman, it's inherent and underlies all of existence. Yeah, and so it's actually the Brahman which everything comes from. Whereas in Buddhism we don't have that conception. You know, the world doesn't come from Nibbana. Yeah? Nibbana is the ending of the world.
Is this the last?
So this, you know, in a cosmological sense, you have this idea that of these kind of the world cycles. You know, so the evolution of the world, you know, is where the world kind of spills out from Brahma. Yeah, and then the whole world evolves, and then at the end of the world cycle, it all goes back into Brahma. Yeah? And so this idea, that respect is very different, and that's very philosophically very crucial, because as soon as you start to involve the absolute in the temporal world, you end up with these massive philosophical problems. Yeah? And any theistic religion runs into the same problems. Yeah? Why? How can the deathless be involved in what is full of death? How can the changeless be involved with what is full of change? So you just have these insuperable philosophical problems, and you end up it just ends up becoming a blind alley. Yeah.
So contain the simile of the turtles, and the ones that there was one turtle sitting on top of another turtle and on
uh-huh.
another turtle.
Yeah.
So in this concept, the last turtle is Brahma.
Brahma's the last turtle, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a full stop.
Yeah. Yeah. And what does the turtle sit on?
Brahma.
Into the temporal. How is it? Right, when it says it's not this, not that, that bit's fine. But then when it says this is the controller of the skies and the controller of the winds and the controller of the worlds and all of these kinds of things, yeah, it's actually playing an active role, sustaining things from moment to moment. Sorry? What's disconnected? Oh, a little bit of disconnection. Well, yeah. Sorry? What? Something like that, yeah. In a somewhat different sense. There's still Nibbana. Even those teachings which want to connect Nibbana and Samsara still not pointing to Nibbana as a kind of controlling force and operating force within Samsara. Yeah.
So we evolve that way.
Evolve what way?
Well, suppose that one's practicing as well, then one evolves towards the other.
Yeah.
Magnetic field.
Magnetic field, yeah, you could understand it as a teleological cause. But then you'd get into a whole nest of other problems.
The problem for Buddhism is that, from a commentator outside of this tradition, the criticism would be you don't explain anything, you just explain it away by making the word of Bhagavan. You don't explain it ontologically.
Mm.
Just decide to be ambiguous.
Yeah, except the word Nibbana is then defined in empirical terms, ending of greed, hatred and delusion. So you can know what greed, hatred and delusion are within yourself. And so then you can infer from that, you can see, so this is the difference between, this is the usage which Kalapahana uses, is metaphysical versus empirical. And so in a metaphysical teaching, there's no basis or no finite or reasonable grounds for inference between your evidence or your data and the conclusion that you want to reach. Whereas in Buddhism, there is. In Buddhism, you say, well, greed, hatred, and delusion, we know what greed is. You know that when you feel greed, you get suffering, and we know that when you let go of that greed, you feel happy. Yeah? And Nibbana is just more of that. So you're just inferring from your experience. You know what hatred is, you know what delusion is. If you keep going that same process, which you already know, then that's what you call Nibbana.
But somewhere along the line,
yeah,
something unexplainable happens ontologically.
Yeah. You go beyond the laws of thermodynamics. Something, yeah? Yeah. It can't be reduced to that. But it's more that there's a... See, Nibbana avoids those philosophical problems. It's not a creator. It's not sort of sustaining the world and all of these kinds of things. Yeah. But it's still true that there is, you know, there is still at the end of the day an irreducible mystery. You know, it's not something that we know. And so we can just, but we can kind of approach it in a reasonable way.
But that's the sutras where the question, the person pushes the question all the way to what is Nirvana working on? Just
the last question. Morris Walsh makes a very good point of that in his introduction to the Digha. He says that you know, when you have this idea of the unconditioned and the unborn, which obviously you have here, and he says that should be used as a criterion of any true religion, is that it has an idea of the unconditioned. And in having a belief in the unconditioned, Buddhism is the same as other religions. But where it differs is that Buddhism is very limited in how it describes that unconditioned, and almost always restricts itself ontologically to negative statements about that unconditioned. So when Yajnavalkya is saying it's not attached, it's not apprehendable, it's not all of these things, then Buddhism wouldn't have a problem with that. But it's then when you want to start to assert positive attributes of it, that then Buddhism would stop.
But its positive aspects are psychological and therefore empirical.
Yeah, the positive in the sense of it's attractive to you, yeah, but not ontologically positive in asserting the existence of it in any way.
This is our reaction from the descriptions of the unborn in the Upanishads that not only does it describe the unborn as controlling, but even if you decide not to describe the unborn as controlling, just say that the unborn is connected to that which is manifest,
right.
Then
you
run into the problem of how can the
changes change? Yeah. And it's the same as the Christian problem of the problem of evil and the existence of God and so on. It's exactly the same. The ontological problem, how can God create the world? It's just different forms of the same thing. Yeah. Just in case you think that the Upanishads are full of exalted philosophy and so on, it also contains, the last chapter of it has some good sex magic and blah blah blah. Now, if one should see himself, his reflection in water, he should recite the following hymn. In me may the gods bestow lustre, vigour, fame, wealth and merit. This verily is loveliness among women when she has removed her soiled clothes. Therefore, when she has removed her soiled clothes and is lovely, he should approach and speak to her. If she does not grant him his desire, he should buy her with presents. If she does still not grant him his desire, he should beat her with a stick or his hands and overcome her with manly power and glory, saying, I take away your glory. Thus she becomes devoid of glory. And then it tells you how to different ways of different when having intercourse, different ways of making dedications, so you can have different kinds of children, whether you want to have a son or a daughter, and different complexions and things like that. You can do different formulas and so on to ensure those things. And some of the menstrual taboos and things like that. At the end, it's got this.
Somebody keep their body books on people, say.
Yeah.
Well, they were angry, but somebody actually put it later on, you know, as a commentary.
Yeah. That's another one. If a man's wife has a lover and the husband hates him, then let him put fire in an this is a curse, black magic for your wife's lover. Let him put fire in an unbaked earthen vessel, spread out a layer of reed arrows in an inverse order, and let him offer sacrifice in inverse order, these reed arrows soaked in clarified butter, saying, "You have sacrificed in my fire. I take away your in-breath and out-breath, you so-and-so. I take away your sons and cattle, your sacrifices and meritorious deeds, your hopes and expectation. Verily he departs from this world impotent and devoid of merit, he who a Brahmana knows these curses. Therefore one should not wish to play with the wife of one who is learned in the Vedas, who knows this, for indeed who knows this becomes punishment." So, and this is taken very, very seriously, in India. The curse of a Brahmin is regarded with utter terror. So, yeah, you don't want to mess with them.